Ben Willie.
Has that situation changed since that, presumably with these two changes in the government, the whole surveillance apparatus would have broken down? Did you say we're worse off than we were before November 1st?
You mean police-wise? Oh, I can't answer that, Jerry. I'm getting out of my area of knowledge, but judging from what I know in Saigon here, they've reorganized the police department twice since 1 November. And with the, I'm sure, the logical disarray, disorganization that's characteristic of all disorganization.
Colonel, would you say the basic deficiencies in this clear and full program can be traced to the civilian agencies and Vietnamese agencies in this country, or will it be a combination of the military and civilian?
Military and civilian.
Military.
Military hands aren't clean.
I mean, what?
The hands of the military aren't clean.
You mentioned this conflict between the mission of a military organization, to fight or to train.
No, that's not a conflict. I say you administer any military organization to fight or train, depending upon whatever you're doing.
To fight and to train.
Or train.
But not, they're not exclusive.
There are two. If you're in the United States, you administered to train. If you were in a division and Europe, why you administered the fight.
While we have a lull here, some of the people who haven't been around as long as others, I might refresh your memory on casualty figures on 61, 2, and 3. DC casualty 61, these are ballpark figures, but they're fairly accurate. 13,000, this is total casualties, 33,062 and 28,063. And the rule of thumb on that deaths is about 75% of that would be killed.
What
is
the 62 figure?
1361, 33 and 62, and 28 and 63. Formerly casualties for the same periods, 9,061, 13,062, 19,063. And about 25% of those usually wind up as CIA.
25%.
About 25%. Right. But the DC casualty were higher than 62 and 63? Right.
Is there a reason for that?
No.
I mean, because we've got more stuff today than we have now. 63 on more.
Well, of course, I think this actually ties in with some earlier remarks about more competence. After all, the guys are fat. Normally, if you fight for 3 years, is a better fighter than the 1 year man.
Well, now, what's the base for this casualty? These are official Vietnamese figures, or this is what's suggested by our intelligence?
These are the best figures that we have, but we got these originally from, I guess, J2 people.
Right.
Roughly, I figured up the other day, I think it's so far in 64, it was about 7,000 on each side.
7,000 on each side?
Yeah.
And what would the ratio be as far as it would still hold up to this?
Well,
75.
Mm-hmm. It's really amazing how it works out, because here, today, this week's casualties, for example, 440 total, with 25% of that would be 110, actually 120.
But you'd say it was even Steven at 7-7 so
far. It was roughly that.
Well, if you were just coming out here now as top man in charge of the whole works, what can the American mission do to improve the management of the war?
Wow. I'd say that get the Vietnamese to establish some realistic priorities.
again, through personal persuasion, or is there some institutional way it can be done?
I do it the same way that we get decisions in the Pentagon. Analyze the problem, prepare briefings, and give them the hard sell. I mean, in the Pentagon, you get decisions, but I mean, the question is, how do you get decisions out of these guys? And the only way I know to do it is just exactly that. Just analyze their problems, reduce it to breathing, or reduce it to writing form, or both, and say, gentlemen, this is my unequivocal recommendation.
Have we not been saying that all the time?
I'm not in a position to comment.
And then say no one leaves the room until we get a decision.
This is the way I did it. Well, hello.
With success?
Yes. I can think of no instance where if you had a logical course of action and your analysis was valid, that you did not get a favorable decision. And a lot of these peripheral areas, critic action and so forth, there may be critical reasons why they can't do certain things. But strictly in military areas, I'd say this is a pretty effective technique.
Isn't that the problem here? The political problem rather than the military? Of getting this across?
Well, I'm convinced that part of our difficulty here is that the leadership in this country, I think, has some sort of vague idea that this war can be settled by political means in their favor. I believe, it appears to me that the vices of the Vietnamese are politics, corruption, and nepotism. And what these little guys are, and the generals themselves, the generals got to be generals, came rose in the ranks by virtue of their ability in political intrigue, not as a result of their ability as military men, and that's one of the basic problems that we have here. And they just love this political intrigue.
I would think that last one would be off the record.
Well, I don't tell anyone anything here, but don't worry
about it. Even to a military spokesman, I don't think they want that attributed to that. My mathematics is wrong. Time goes faster than I thought it did. I thought recently I added this up. It's 9,000 on each side, rather than 7,000.
That would make it 14 for the year, that thing.
Why is it, Colonel, that the Viet Cong don't seem to suffer from this ailment? Nepotism and corruption.
Well, I see. The whole theory of communism, that this is a disciplined, highly disciplined organization. But what communism, the reason that communism is being successful, in my opinion, is many of these damn countries are, in this country, for instance, in Cambodia and Laos, basically what you're dealing with is a country that's right out of the Middle Ages, 900,000 years behind the time. What these people have done is introduced a highly disciplined 19th century, if you please, technique for the purpose of seizing control.
Ho Chi Minh has complained very bitterly of corruption.
Well,
yes, tell me about a year ago.
Well, as you know, corruption can be relative. And I'm sure that he has corrupted corruption, but the question is it as corrupt under the communist as it is under a free society? And the reason that these little guys are so successful is that they're dedicated. They're working at their job 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, and they're absolutely convinced that they're going to win. They're absolutely convinced that their cause is right, and that the remainder of the 20th century belongs to us communists. Now, we could allow a similar dedication in the So in Vietnamese leaders, I'm convinced we can change the course of the war.
You think we can do that, Colonel?
Well, I'd say that one of our techniques that I'm talking about, we got to convince these little guys they've got to hang together or they're going to hang separately. Because there's no question in my mind that if Ho Chi Minh wins, that there's a hell of a lot of them hang separately. They're sure in the hell not going to occupy the positions of prominence. And be on the public payroll, such as they are right now. I mean, that's
why I should have changed your plans to ground for a few
months. I think that's a good knowing, Mr. Code. One thing that the Colonel mentioned there, I don't have a better specific figure to offer, but I don't think that his 90% probably tallies with some of the estimates on the amount of captured material.
I wouldn't defend it. You asked me, and I just heard something. I assure you, though, if you get out in these small unit actions, you'd be surprised to know what percentage of the weapons are bars, M1s, carbines, Thompson submachine guns.
There's one other thing that occurred there, and I didn't want to interrupt him at the time. He mentioned the figure of 30,000, and I think I know what he meant by it. If you weren't referring to it today, that's the figure of hardcore, is 30,000. We're talking about the people who are
the southern
you know.
Maybe down here and then go back. And,
what is your estimate of the hardcore here?
I've been dealing in nice figures, I don't know.
I haven't checked this in the last week or so, but as far as I know, we're still carrying 22-25. I know some estimates are higher than that, but that's what we're still using.
22-25,000?
22-25,000 hardcore.
That's a
thousand
change.
You haven't changed very much. For a while, it was down, I think it's 17 and 62, I believe it was. But since I've been here, it's vacillated between, one time they got down as low as 20 to 25 and then decided that the 20 was too low and buzzed back to 22.
What are you going to do now,
Colonel? Go on to the Department of the Army.
Colonel said retirement, is that right?
Oh, eventually.
Thank you very much.
Thanks a lot. Thanks for being with us. Just like any of the others.
At what point did the headquarters know that some condition would be?
Because this is further. Gentlemen, you've heard me before refer to the man who succeeded me as J3, a Mac 3, as the finest brigadier general in the United States Army. And I think that speaks at least my estimate of General William E. Depew's capabilities and potential. J3 of Mac 3. The role he performed over these past several days was that as special representative of General Westmoreland in the Bombardier Dialogue area. Once he was sent as a Thursday last week because of the increasing complexity of the political-military situation, which was a direct and proximate result of the Rade rebellion. And once on the ground, he became the overall manager and director of the U.S. effort with its political-military aspect from that point forward. Colonel Freund, whose name is extremely familiar to all of you as a result of this past week, is normally the deputy senior advisor to the Second Corps commanded by General Cole. He arrived in Bonnetouille Sunday morning with the Corps commander, Sunday morning the 20th, and was in that area, Bonnetouille, going to far until this afternoon. Colonel John Wentz, near with me, is the
deputy advisor, deputy division advisor, 23rd Division, headquartered in Barstow. The story that these gentlemen are about to tell is one that is filled with drama. They are the exponents and the really principal luminaries of an effort, I must say, that involved the coordination and successful integration of a lot of work by a lot of Americans in the field, of whom we're terribly proud. But from amongst those, we have, in the simple shorthand of Colonel Kirsting, the division advisor, General Pugh as the author and producer, Colonel Wendt as the director, and Colonel John Freund as the star. And with that beginning, I would say, Bill, this is yours right now.
If I could make one change, Lieutenant Colonel Irving Wendt, and it's this town in Minnesota or Michigan?
Michigan.
M-I-L-A-N, Milan, Michigan. And Colonel Freund is Scarborough, New York.
My family are living in Vienna, Virginia, but I come from Scarborough.
Originally from Scarborough, and we're down at Vienna, Virginia. The only few that I mind to ask not about, what are you claiming as your hometown these days?
Washington.
D.C.
Well, General Stilwell suggested that I say something at the outset. However, I'm aware of the fact that you gentlemen are here really to listen to Colonel Freund, and both Colonel Wendt and I will be here to answer questions, any of those which might require the views of someone who is outside Bones for Five. I would like to say, however, so that it's very clear, that whereas Colonel Freund was clearly the star of the show, Colonel Wendt performed some services which were far above and beyond the call of duty. He traveled back and forth to the camp continuously every day, several times a day. He went under weather conditions in which no duck would ordinarily fly. And on the last night of the last day of the actual operation, he drove that road to Lone Star Pah, leaving at 4 o'clock in the morning, and got down there all right. And that road, you gentlemen may know, is not the kind of a road you like to drive on at night in this particular situation. And when you get right down to it, it was the communications which Colonel Wendt provided that made it possible to solve the problem as it was solved without bloodshed, which has been the objective from the beginning. I will not say any more and ask Colonel Freund to go ahead and tell what happened at Bones for Pah. I would, however, generally forestall some perhaps obvious questions, say that during all the time that I was at Bonmatuit, there was there a senior representative of General Kahn who was in charge of all of the operations in that area, with whom I was in, I should say, repeated contact day and night over several days, and that everything that we did was done with the full knowledge and coordination and approval or request by either General Din or General Kim or General Ko or General Long. And this was true throughout the entire operation, in which the Americans there sought first to bring about a meeting between the leaders of the Rade and the authorities of the government of Vietnam, so so that they could talk and solve their problems. And later in the week, when after days had passed and the leaders simply did not appear and the government had demonstrated its patience and had avoided any aggressive or unreasonable acts, notwithstanding the fact that there had been atrocities at the outset, it became necessary in order to, at a critical point or two, to effect the release of the prisoners, which was certainly a precondition psychologically to solving any of the problems. And lastly, to remove the American team on Monday morning. All of those things were done at the request of the government of Vietnam. The fact that they were done successfully was the outgrowth of Colonel Freund's most remarkable performance, a performance the likes of which I think no Army officer has produced in recent times. And owing to the courage and the willingness to go back and forth and carry the important messages on the part of Colonel Wendt. Fritz, would you go ahead, please?
I think you'll have to discount a little of this in that it makes me blush to even listen to some of these words. It wasn't quite exactly like that. But let me just simply describe it to you. I've made a few notes, and if you don't mind, I'll from time to time refer to these, and it's simply because I feel that in the interests of time from your standpoint, and also in the interests of giving you as complete a picture as possible, I've put together some of this on paper. You know, one gets a self-conscious feeling being singled out for recognition for something which really was not the action of a single person at all, but was really the action of a team. Actually, it was a number of teams. We had a team on the ground at Bun Sap Ba. There was a liaison team. You could refer really to Colonel Wendt as a team all of his own. We had a team of pilots. We had a team of front office people, the people who really directed the operation, the people who made liaison with the home headquarters here in Saigon. Colonel Wendt, as the general has mentioned, was very important to our operation. The first thing in the morning, as soon as the weather would break, we could count on the helicopter coming in. It was almost like clockwork. Everyone in the camp became familiar with his face. And he would stay there just long enough to debrief me, and this sometimes took a lengthy period of time. I remember one occasion, we had just gotten started in talking together, and the leaders in the camp wanted to have a little meeting, and so there was a break of about 3 hours of time before we got started again. But let me not go into this too much. Let me just spend a moment to describe this team that I was talking about. In our little group, we had, let's say, on the day of the liberation of the prisoners, which was on Sunday the 27th, we had one additional officer and four enlisted men. The officer was a Captain Sharp, and he was a communications expert. Communications involves real problems, and without his assistance, we would have been in real trouble. Sergeant Carroll was the senior sergeant, and he was the operations man on the scene.
and he coordinated the activities of the other enlisted personnel. I had a Sergeant Hill, who was a demolitions expert, a Sergeant Clark, who was a medic, and a Sergeant Wyndham, who was a weapons expert. One of the things that we did was every man was always kept informed of the situation. This is normal in the military. We had skull sessions, and everyone had an opportunity to put in a word as to how we would do things. You see, when you run a military operation, the front office gives you the guidelines, but they allow you on the field enough liberty to run the operation in conformity with the way the situation actually looks on the ground. On this particular day, we decided finally on trying to achieve the liberation of the prisoners with a single-handed approach. Sometimes the most unexpected action is really the best. If, for instance, on that day, an attempt had been made to force the release of the prisoners, it would certainly have resulted in bloodshed. Now, this approach was provided from the headquarters in Bonn-Mattur, General Bacuse headquarters, and we were the people to carry it out. Now, major problem in going into this sort of an approach to releasing prisoners is being able to get an audience. In other words, it was a major problem to just arrange to have all of the prisoners, all of the Montagnard personnel there to listen. And it was a second problem to get someone to interpret. Feeling was very strong that the prisoners should be retained. It was felt that the prisoners must be retained at all costs because they felt that they had to have the prisoners for their own safety. We knew that this was not necessary. We knew that the continued retention of the prisoners actually made the situation much more difficult. And we tried to bring this point across to the Montagnards. You can imagine that the atmosphere, if I could describe it for a moment, standing on top of a machine gun position, sandbagged in, with all of the Montagnards around. I had an interpreter who was not the best in the camp, but it turned out that the best in the camp was the leader in the camp. And he didn't really want to translate this. On the other hand, he had been the one who had brought all of the men together. The entire presentation was in French, major reason being that there are always a number of people in this country who understand French, and it worked out well this time because on a number of occasions the man who was interpreting was prompted by people in the audience. Now, some of the major points that were made I think you'd be interested in. First was that there are no other prisoners in any of the other camps. Secondly, that the government, meaning the Vietnamese government, had been extremely patient. Thirdly, that the retention of prisoners was an increasing source of irritation. And then I simply asked them, what was the value of retaining these prisoners? It was also pointed out that if the government forces desired, they could certainly take the post. They could certainly destroy the defenses. And then they were asked whether it was worth trading the temporary custody of these prisoners for the possible loss or jeopardy of 400 military lives, not to mention those of the numerous dependents who are also in the area. Now, these main points had to be interspersed with other points, some of which were that our past record of friendship and cooperative effort had achieved real results, and that we had a sincere desire to continue. I also expressed my personal affection for the Rabe soldier. I'd only been in the theater a relatively short period of time. Practically, my entire contact with the Montagnard was achieved during that particular period. I must say that as individuals, I liked them tremendously. And I tried to express this. I mentioned a nighttime visit to one of their barracks. Now, this may be amusing to you. One evening, while making a check of the perimeter posts, probably 9:30, 10:30 at night, I heard a lot of noise from one of the barracks. And so I went into the barracks area, and a number of the men were talking loudly. When they saw me, they jumped up and the word spread around the barracks, "Vigono." And I asked them what the trouble was. And they said that that night they'd only had rice for supper, no vegetables, no meat. Well, I told them that, you know, this is sort of like soldiers everywhere. The soldier never has enough to eat. The soldier never gets enough pay. I told him there's one thing that soldiers always have, and that's a song. And so they got started singing Rabe's songs. And then they brought out that strange musical instrument that they have, which is like a gourd with bamboo poles sticking out of it. And it was like a Rabe jam session. I brought that to them. And I asked, how many of you were there that night? And a number of them raised their hands. Also, you know, at night, when you're making an inspection of the posts, you're hitting the sentries or you're hitting the weapons positions. There's always a challenge. At night, of course, you can't see the person that's coming. You usually hear them first. Or if you see the shadowy person, you can't identify him, so you always the challenge rings out. And in the Montagnard language, the challenge goes like this. I asked the very first night what I should respond to, how I should respond to this challenge, and I was told that I should answer, "Cow." I later learned that "cow" simply means "I." Perhaps they responded differently, but this way they were able to know who I was. And so I asked them there, I said, I had the interpreter ask, how many of you in the black of night, when it's raining, when it's cold, when at any time of the night, have made the challenge, "Lenin," and heard the answer come back, "Kao." At that point, every man raised his hand, and every man said the equivalent of, "I." Well, it was this sort of an approach. In the very end, I looked around for leaders. One of the leaders, the leader, had actually departed. He left it about in the very early phases. In a sense, and this is sort of a little difficult to explain, this was a vote of confidence. If he had stayed, he would have been forced, I think, to say something to countermand what I was about to do. And he, I think, was perhaps the only person who was able to recognize at an early point what I was about to do. I tried to keep it secret, but I never gave away exactly what I was going to do until the very last moment. Finally, I simply said to them that for your own security, and I sincerely meant it, and believe that this is exactly what it was, for their own security, for their own welfare, in the interests of their people, it was to their advantage that the prisoners be released. In pointing it out to all the soldiers, I said that I don't want any of you to take the responsibility for shooting an American officer. If this is to be done, let it be done by one of your leaders. During the time of this talk, there was a chum, a member of the chum tribe, who was inserting comments every now and then. In short, he was sort of, he was needling, where I would say one thing, I'm sure he was saying something quite to the contrary. And so at that crucial moment before I was getting ready to take off and release the prisoners personally, I thrust my weapon into his hand and said, I actually hit him in the chest with it like this and said to him, "You take the weapon. You be the first, you be the one to fire." And he turned around and ran away. And then I took the acting battalion commander and I tried to force the weapon on him. And he wouldn't take it. He kept backing away from it. So I put the weapon back on my shoulders again. We went over to the compound. I had a pair of clippers in my hand. We're starting to clip the, we had sort of a barbed wire, if you can imagine it, entangled around two posts, one post part of the door, and then a padlock there, tying the whole business together, and gotten through a few strands on this, and then one of the men came rushing up, and he put the key to the padlock and opened it himself. The district chief was the first one to come out, and everyone else followed him. From there, we went down to the second compound, took the prisoners out from there. I mentioned the team operation, a superb team operation, because as we were marching from the second prisoner compound to the airstrip, the choppers were right in the air and they were landing just as we got there. So you see, it really wasn't as difficult a thing as may perhaps have been imagined. There's one school of thought that considers this situation to have been very dangerous. The Rade tribesmen are very sensitive, warm-hearted people. I personally don't think they would have fired on me anyway. I think that's about the story, General.
Well, I'm sure that provides enough meat so that we can proceed to a question period.
Colonel, when did you actually get to the town and why?
The circumstances were as follows. the particular unit from Bensa Pass was located at the time I arrived on Sunday, a week ago, at a little town called Boone Bay, which is about 14 kilometers out of Van Matuit. I'd gone out there at the express request of General Carr, the Second Corps commander, to see what could be done about getting these people to return to their home base, Bensa Pass. After some discussion, they agreed to return if I would go with them. And I did this, and that's how I happened to get there.
Had you ever been to the camp before?
I had never been to that particular camp before.
At the time of beginning to cut the wire, and immediately before that, where were the other members of your team with you? How close were they to you?
If you could imagine a situation in which, let us say that you are the Rade tribesman, and I'm standing on top of this table, which is actually the sandbags up a little higher than that. Off to your right, about 20 yards, there's one of our buildings with a projection on the front like a porch. Our team members were sitting on that porch without arms. And it was brought to the attention of the Rade tribesmen at the very beginning that they were standing there without arms and that I was the only man there with arms.
What was that
like? I carry a Swedish cape. A Swedish K. It's a type of submachine gun, sometimes in our parlance referred to as a grease gun.
Colonel, were there any persons in that camp that you would regard as Viet Cong, either belonging to the Rade or from outside?
I have heard many rumors that in these camps, there's always a percentage of VC. I cannot, from personal experience, validate this.
Can you give us some details of the interpreter when you say it was a leader?
PWs, defectors. Or VC, and we want them out of here. I don't know who they were, and I didn't see them, and that's what I was told.
Of our acquaintanceship, he was certainly military. However, he was not the battalion commander. If you can imagine an echelon above the battalion commander, then this is where he stood. He was 22 years old. And one of the most capable young men I have ever seen. He had the complete respect of all of his tribesmen. And when he said something, there was little doubt as to what was to be done.
Can we do this with you?
I feel that the problem of the names and the various leaders in there, we couldn't get into very deeply for the reasons of sensitivity right at this point, and I'm going to ask Colonel Foyne not to answer that question.
What about the leader of the camp who you said disappeared in the early stages? We heard about him hiding in the jungle or something. Did you see him before?
If I may say, this is a misunderstanding from the way Colonel Floyd says it. The leader that disappeared, that he was talking about, was just moved away 50 feet or so during his talk.
But I thought you had referred to some of the early stages of the rebellion. You were not able, toward the end, on the day of liberation, you were not able to find the leader of the rebellion because he had disappeared from the camp in the early stages of the rebellion. Ibrahim.
Well, Ibrahim had never been in the camp at all.
So you never laid eyes on him?
Well, I had known him before.
No.
I had known him before. I met him in Ban Mathurt, and then I believe he was deputy to the province chief there, Major Jack.
But you never saw him at all during this week at the camp?
I did not.
Or had any contact with him?
There were messages that were sent.
And received?
Yes. Just to clarify this so as not to leave any doubts in anyone's mind, it was the continued demand placed by us on the Rabe tribesmen to release the prisoners. This was a demand that was made the very first day we arrived, and on every subsequent day, not once, sometimes many times. And there was simply an appeal to him to give the order for this release.
Colonel Flynn's role at the time, at our request, was to act as a communication link, hopefully with Ibrahim, or whoever the leaders are. Frankly, we don't know who the leaders are, whether it's Ibrahim, whether it's other people, whether he's there because he wanted to be there, whether he was there because someone was keeping him there. In fact, for the matter is, we simply do not know, except that the communications that Colonel Freund transmitted for the government to what apparently was the leadership that had gone away out of Ban Sarpah and away from Ban Mathurt, was to Ibrahim. And he did not choose, nor did any of his cohorts, whom he must have had some, ever choose to come back. This was done by word-of-mouth type messenger, and notes were written by Colonel Freund in French and sent over to him.
You would write a note, you would have a message on your radio, write it down in French, hand it to somebody?
No, these things were never put in on the radio. Things of this importance, to be sure that there was enough precision here in following the desires of the higher headquarters, these messages were all relayed by Colonel Wendt.
And then you would give them to somebody in the camp, and
yes,
it would
disappear.
And,
yes,
and then you might get an answer, and you might not.
How long it took to transmit it?
It varied, and I presume that this perhaps was because of the difficulties of going down jungle terrain, sometimes at night, sometimes in bad weather.
How many replies? Do you know that the replies you received were from Ibrahim? Were signed by him?
Yes, we did know that they came from him.
There were written messages.
There was a written message.
You thought the time to elapse the fact of the message?
There were verbal messages also. And I think that the time varied from...
You mean the day on which the last message was sent?
No,
the last time?
The average or minimal
I'd say something on the order of about 10 hours.
Non-directional.
10 hours from, and based on your experience, how far would a man travel 10 hours,
I think? We had some discussion time at the other end. So how do you know?
They say, and in addition to this, it could mean one thing if you were going down relatively flat terrain. It could mean something entirely different if you were going through mountainous terrain. It could mean one thing if you were going in darkness. It could mean another thing if you were going at night. It could mean one thing if you were going in good weather, another thing if you were going in poor weather. It could mean one thing if during part of the during part of the movement, you had to go through area which was perhaps VC infested and take special precautions, detouring, for instance, off a known trail, and something else if it didn't. In other words, there are so many imponderables, it's very difficult in this particular situation to really assess any difference, any distance.
But in any event, he could easily have gone to Cambodia and back within that time, wouldn't you say?
That seems to be the main point. How far is Bumrah Pai exactly from the border?
Not many kilometers, but on the other hand, I have the personal feeling. And this is strictly a personal view. That wherever the base was, it was within Vietnam.
Why did you feel that?
I presume it was from discussions, the general feelings I gathered in my discussions with the camp leaders.
Could you characterize the communications you had in any way, describing the tone of them? A hostile tone, a military tone in any way? How would you generally?
They were certainly not hostile. On the other hand, they did not agree with the, they did not provide the desired result.
Did he know who you were? Did you?
Yes, he did.
He remembered you? And
he remembered me quite well.
Dear friend?
No, hardly then.
Did you ever ask to be taken to a big
problem? No, I never did.
Colonel, I understood that there were two communications, in fact, from him, which were quite different in style, both in French and both with his signature, but quite different in phrasing. Okay.
I saw those two letters. That's right.
One was scrawled on a little piece of paper, and the other one was in a regular envelope.
Well, then the, you said one written message.
There was one, I guess I should say, formal written message, and the other one was rather informal. I don't even believe the second one was signed, was it?
No, they're both signed. One of them was written by one person, another written by another, both signed by Ibrahim.
Yeah.
Those letters were, of course, addressed to Colonel Friend, and we handed them to General Dean, who, to the best of my knowledge, still has them.
You can tell me another thing. This has been a security meeting.
During which meeting?
During the
meeting. Yes. As a matter of fact, they maintained very good security because they were reminded all of the time that while we were certain that the Vietnamese forces would not attack them, there was always the possibility of an attack by the VC. And they were very much on the alert during that period of time. All guard posts were always manned.
Was there any effort at any time to disarm you?
There was never an effort made to disarm me. But it was very clearly pointed out to them in the beginning that I wasn't going to be disarmed without force.
Colonel, if I could interrupt just a minute. You are an Annapolis graduate, I understand. I think we'd all like to know your age and something a little bit about your personal history before arriving at this particular point.
Well, compared to all of the men I've been dealing with, I'm an old man of 36. I graduated from the United States Naval Academy in 1930. Actually, I was thrown out of the Navy. I couldn't pass the eye standards when I graduated, and very shortly after I got out of the Naval Academy, I received a regular Army commission. This dated back, if you want to be precise, to 25 June 1940.
What were you doing during the war?
Went to North Africa in April of 1943 and was fortunate enough to be able to take the grand tour, which included Sardinia, Italy, Corsica, southern France, or France, I should say, Alsace and Lorraine, and finally Germany.
Korea?
I was not in Korea.
Were you commanding troops then?
Yes, I was. During the war, I was with troops all the time, the entire time. Until after the war, remember they had the point system, and our unit had so many points that the entire outfit dissolved overnight almost. And then I went to a headquarters staff for about 6 or 8 months until April of 1946, at which time I returned to the States.
You were commissioned as an artillery officer here?
Yes.
And what was the date of your arrival here in Vietnam?
I arrived on the 17th of August.
And your family status?
I'm married. I'm proud father of three sons, John Frederick, Peter Christoph, and Bruce Randall.
Okay, Peter Christoph.
How old are you? Boys are 15 is the oldest, 13, John is 15, Peter is 13, Bruce is 12.
Is this your first?
This is my first tour in the area.
This is the
area. I found it the most interesting one. We spoke French and German at home. And I've had the occasion to visit France a number of times. And of course studied it in school. Incidentally, this is not unusual. There are many, many, many U.S. officers who speak French and other languages.
These lines of persuasion that you mentioned as you were standing up there on the sandbag, was this our instruction, or did you and Colonel Wynn sort of work them out together, or did they come to you as you were standing there, or what?
One of the basic principles of a military operation, and this was a military operation, is prior planning. So obviously it wasn't something that was just done on the spur of the moment. On the other hand, this is one of those cases in which you are given leeway in the field. The basic operation was directed by General Depew, but he didn't tell me how to carry it out. He left that pretty much to us on the ground. After making up the main points, we had one of these skull sessions I was referring to earlier, and all of the men got all of the points that were going to be inserted in this particular presentation, and they brought up many comments, and these were incorporated. As a matter of fact, some of them were of particular importance.
I was just about to make a decision whether
we should have been having a threat. How many did you ask?
Yes.
There were 56 military and 4 civilian.
I'd like to ask General DePue a question. The government today, the Vietnamese government, released a fairly blunt communique which described the success at Buon Sapar as the result of having cracked the whip on them, in effect. It said that having shown patience for a period of 8 days, it was they were finally told that they must surrender or be crushed by Second Corps units, which had been ordered to ring the camp and move in if necessary. The communique made no mention of the American role at all in this thing. I was just wondering if you felt free to comment.
I don't feel free to comment. I wasn't there at the time they entered the camp. General Cole told me exactly what happened at the camp. No shot was fired. They rather were requested urgently by Colonel Friend as he left. As a matter of fact, he and I both told them at that point that they must not fire and that the Arvin would not fire at them, and it was in their interest not to, for obvious reasons. And they wouldn't, and we didn't expect them to.
The only part of the communique that I was wondering about, it was stated that the success at Buon Sapar was the result of force of arms of Second Corps, which demonstrated the continued authority of the armed forces.
I think that the government displayed a considerable amount of military force at that time, which I'm sure was persuasive. They had more than 2 battalions. I think, however, rather recognized from the beginning that the Arvin could move in at any time they wanted to. I don't think there's ever been any doubt in anybody's mind on that score.
Based on your observations out there within the last 2 days, General, what do you feel will be the effect of this rebellion on the one hand working with the Vietnamese and the U.S. against the Viet Cong?
I have high hopes that it will improve. The question you ask, I have a feeling that the rebellion is over, that the authority of the government has been reestablished, that the rebel is being misled by someone to commit the atrocities they did at the beginning, that they see the error of those particular errors, and although they still are determined that they're